correctly, help me out if I'm wrong, is that we laid out the issue that the gittin needs to be given a beratzo, needs to be given willingly, and that poses a problem when you have a marriage that is essentially over, and one part or the other isn't interested. It's usually portrayed that the issue is that the husband isn't interested in ending the marriage, but Ashkenazi practice nowadays requires both parties to agree, so potentially there could be a problem on either end. It's true that there are significant differences in the consequences of the problem as far as mamzerus and the like, and whether there is recourse to any other remedies, which is a discussion we haven't gotten up to yet. We'll see if we do get up to it. But strictly speaking, as a matter of basic practical halacha in the Ashkenazi world in 2017, the basic rule is that divorce has to be mutual, that both parties have to agree. And therefore, if either party decides to try to cause problems, the possibility exists. So the question is, what can be done about it? So in the context of male recalcitrants, so the Gemara and the Mishnah and Ksubas do tell us that there are times when it's possible to be kofed. Again, this is just a very quick recap of some of the main points that we discussed last time. We're not going to get into as many details, we did then, just to kind of get us up to speed. So there is theoretically the possibility of kfiya, the possibility of forcing someone to issue a get. The Mishnah mentions this in the context of a few limited cases, mostly having to do with physical disabilities or other situations in terms of what one does for an occupation or things like that, that have an impact on the person's livability with, if you want to call it that. And therefore, under those circumstances, a bezdin can compel a get. So therefore, what we see is that even though a get has to be willing, and therefore to be me'asa get, meaning to make someone else be osa it, should be a problem, and that's the issue that's known as get me'usa. But there are times when we do have ma'asin begitten, as the Gemara says in the Masechet Gittin, that there are times when we compel gittin, and those times are under these circumstances, and it has to be done through Jewish hands, through the psak of a bezdin. And we spent a little bit of time last week trying to clarify how this could work, so isn't there somewhat of a tension between saying it has to be willing and saying that it's possible to compel? And this is what brought up perhaps the most famous Rambam in Mishneh Torah, considered that might be the case, because of its often citation, in frequent citation in even the secular press, that the Rambam says it's possible to compel because even though this person is saying he doesn't want to, this doesn't really reflect his real will, this reflects just his Yetzirah, and the Pintel Yid, the Rambam would have said, had he written in Yiddish, the Pintel Yid inside really wants to do this, and therefore we're just encouraging the Pintel Yid to come out and express his true Ratzon. So this is a unique take on it. It could be that there are proofs from Chazal like this. It could be that there are other sources that support this idea. But this is essentially the way the Rambam understands it. And it's led to some discussion. I don't think we mentioned last week the Ma'arik. The Beis Yosef quotes the Ma'arik, who raises the question of, are there people then who wouldn't fit into this category? What if somebody, let's say, is a mummer? Let's say somebody has disconnected from the influence of halacha completely. Would we still say that there is a Pintel Yid? It's not so sure. And some later svarim said, why should you bring up such a question? Why do you assume the Pintel Yid ever dies? It could be that even when somebody has disconnected from everything else, there still is this rux. There's no way to know necessarily that there's a limit to this logic, and that maybe no matter how a person has distanced themselves from the rest of Torah Mitzvahs, maybe this ember is still there that we can seize and therefore tell them to do the right thing. So the question is, what's the Rambam talking about when he says it's the right thing? So there are a couple of different understandings of what this is, whether it's an issue of Yahat Berech Kamocha. We saw last week the Rashbam and Bava Basra, who doesn't use this term, but it sounds a little bit like he's alluding to Kofen al Midas Stone, that essentially there is a Sodom-like aspect here that the husband, the language the Rashbam uses, husband is not getting anything out of this marriage. She hates him. There's nothing positive going on for him. Therefore, all he's doing is keeping her tied to him for nothing. So maybe he's alluding to something along the lines of Kofar Midas Tov, that we find that we compel people not to be like that, not to be cruel people who want others to suffer slash not benefit even when there isn't any potential gain for us. We discussed a little bit also the Tosfos about why the Gemara compares this to Tzluhu V'Zavid, that the Gemara says you compel somebody to sell something, it's considered to be sold, even though it's not right to do this in the first place, presumably because of Losachmo or related themes. But somebody who sells something under duress, so the sale is valid, because the assumption is that even if he says he doesn't want to do it, but he accepts the money in the end, so in the end he comes to peace with it. We mentioned how this is really an extension of a theory that all sale is essentially under duress, because maybe if you never had any need for money, you would never give up on anything. So the fact that you ever sell something is only because you have to choose between that and having the income that you need. So if we can say that you agree to it under those circumstances, maybe it's true in a broader sense as well. So Tosfos raises the question, well, why is this called a sale? This is really called a gift. The Gemara says if you compel somebody to give a gift, that's not considered to be valid because you don't have this logic that they're accepting the payment that makes it into a valid deal after the fact. So why is forcing somebody to divorce his wife comparable to a sale? It should be comparable really to a gift. And Tosfos has two approaches. One approach basically saying that the monetary issues, the monetary obligations that the husband has, that he'll now be released from, makes this into a wash. So essentially it's like a sale. Or because of the mitzvah, that makes it like a sale. Let me draw a little bit of a comparison to a Gemara by the Shabbos Aveda to raise the question what exactly that means. We're not sure if it means that he's profiting in the sense of doing the mitzvah, or he is essentially commanded to do this, so therefore it's like a sale, whether he gets paid or not. That logic is enough to consider it valid. So, in any event, you seem to have this idea that there is a mitzvah that is compelling us. So, what's the mitzvah? The mitzvah could be like the Chasam Sofer writes in the Tshuva, "Behavta l'reicha kamocha." Maybe it could be some stone idea. Or, what's most likely the case, just in terms of how this whole system operates, is that it's the mitzvah l'shmo adivr chachamim, as the Gemara invokes in one place, that since there is a directive from Chazal, or from the local rabbinate, that also can be viewed as the primary mitzvah here that is the motivating force. So that's one of the reasons that nowadays there is a strong focus on having a psak from Beis Din in order to enter into this discussion, because you want to be clear that there is a mitzvah, even though just to mention, and it's something that we deal with a lot, is that nowadays you have to spend some time figuring out the difference in different Piskei Beis Din, because it's a difference that the Shulchan Aruch mentions that exists between mitzvah lagarish and chiyuv lagarish and kofin lagarish. There seems to be different gradations, and that there's one level where we tell somebody that you're obligated to divorce, and apparently a different level where we actually take the step of kfiya. So what exactly falls into which category is an important discussion, and sometimes it becomes a little bit of a project trying to analyze different psukim with different contemporary bat din as far as what exactly they're trying to say, what's the category, is there a distinction between one or the other? It sounds like from the Shulchan Aruch that there is. What does it mean in terms of practical bat din that can sometimes be a complicated endeavor? So that's one approach, to say that essentially there's a mitzvah in these circumstances, and the mitzvah l'shmo divrei chachamim is the operative element here. And that could be really seen in two levels. It could be the mitzvah to listen to the chachamim of that generation who have instructed through the Beis Din a directive, or it could be in the broader sense that whenever you feel that there's the category in Chazal of kofin l'garish that is relevant, so then we can attributed not only to the contemporary Beis Din, but to the Beis Din of Chazal, the Chachamim, of that capital Ches Chachamim, and that could mean what we're talking about when we say Mitzvah L'Shmo Adivr Chachamim. So there is a Yes, sir?
Is that second Is that second understanding, mitzvah ishmoiz rechachamim, is that specifically about the rule of kidei nashim, or is that in general? Is that like a general?
Well, in general, I believe the mitzvah ishmoiz rechachamim, but you talked about for kfiyah purposes?
Yeah.
Well, the truth is, we find a lot of other contexts as well, because when there's a psak of bezdin in a non-get related matter, we also find kfiyah as an option. And the Gemara in Subas talks also about kfiyah by mitzvos in general, including mitzvos to Rabbanan. So, theoretically, in those cases, it's less frequently invoked, especially in the mitzvah case, but it's kind of a gradation. In the mitzvah case, we don't find so much. Bezdin in non-get matters a little bit more so, or get matters the most. But, yeah, theoretically, it's a concept that does transcend this. So, one approach is to say that that's what's operative here. There is a minority view, it's a little bit disputed if this is really the understanding or not, that what the Mishnah is talking about is afkeinu rabbanan l'kedushin mineh. That Chazal essentially used the power vested in them to declare certain marriages which they considered to be fundamentally dysfunctional to be actually halachically dysfunctional based on their authority of Afkinu, and that's why kfiya is both an obligation and a possibility, because since these marriages are somehow already weakened, already undermined, so apparently that accounts for the ability to do it through kfiya, and the chiyuv of kfiya stems from that. So that's a minority view. There's a little bit of a discussion later as far on whether that's really understanding these Rishonim are saying or not. But it is something that plays a role in the later discussion, because a major issue in Rishonim and a major issue in later Poskim is the list that we find in Chazal. Some of them are in one Mishnah, some of them are scattered around a little bit, but there's a handful of cases in Chazal where kfiyah is mentioned as a possibility. So do we assume that that list is exhaustive, that's the whole list? Or do we say that no, that these are just some examples, and it's possible either to add on to the list, or it's possible to read the list as categories that may include things that are not so obviously on the list? This has some pretty massive implications, the question of whether you can add things to the kfiyah list, or again, say things were always there, just not identified specifically. One of the major, major possible ramifications is, Rav Shechter Shlita has a chiddush, which is not what you find so much in many other poskim, that he assumes that kfiyah is theoretically shayich if the couple isn't living together. If the couple is no longer together, that, and he sees this as not even really a new category, but an extension of the existing categories, because the assumption is that the reason the Mishnah listed these things is because these are things which make it impossible to have a functional marriage. So one could say, the logic certainly is understandable, that kal v'chomer, if they're not living together, eimcha non-functional marriage, God only zeh, and therefore certainly you can apply the kfiyah logic. So that's an understandable approach. It's not an approach that a broad range of posts can have. There are some suggestions from some earlier svarim, the Chaim Pelagi, a little bit in some svarim earlier than that, that there's a certain period of time, 12 months, 18 months, after which it seems that reconciliation isn't really so plausible, that maybe kfiyah should kick in, but a number of later poskim were not too excited about that. It's just an important point to take, to be aware of, take question in a second, but what we'll talk about, ultimately, we'll talk about the prenups, or let's say about demonstrations by Ora and the like, are not working off the premise that kfiyah is being utilized. This is more of a theoretical point. It's just an important point that adds some background support, especially because it means that most of the Aguna cases that we're talking about nowadays, kind of by definition, would be kfiyah cases if this were an accepted position, because it's generally the case that they're not living together. So this is definitely a major element that would add a lot to the story. But the premise of the mechanisms that we're familiar with here are not working off the assumption that kfiya is justified. That's just an important point to keep in mind, as sometimes they'll be justified for other reasons, but they are not working off the premise that they are kfiya in the first place, and therefore that they require justification for kfiya. Does that make sense? Is that understandable? Okay, now we had a...
So Shechem's finish is that you can have kfiya if people aren't living together?
Yeah, that basically all of these examples are situations where the couple is living together and yet it's not a tenable situation. So what's less tenable than people who aren't even living together in the first place? So that... Yeah, so there's two levels of question here. There's really three levels of question. There's a lot of levels, you know, it's a lot to follow here. One level is, can we add things to the kfiya list? Second level would be, even if we're not ready to add things, but maybe it's fair to say that there are certain things that are included in the list of kfiya that we find in the Mishnah, and that wouldn't even constitute adding. But the third level, which we haven't got up to yet, but I was just trying to call your attention to a minute ago, is that we then have to figure out what methods rise to the level of kfiya and what don't, because if something is not considered to be kfiya, then we don't even need these justifications in the first place. So essentially, there's a couple of layers to get through in terms of figuring out what the story is nowadays. So this question of whether Afkenu is a play or whether it's Mitzvah L'shmua Divrei Chachamim is an important one, because it sounds like if it's about Chachamim's instruction, that should probably allow more latitude. And it probably should be the case that contemporary Chachamim should have the authority to say that they perceive a situation as a kfiya situation, and that should be enough. While if you are more conservative about it for whatever reason, so then that becomes more limited. A number of the Rishonim were very strong about this in saying that they believe the situation is limited. The Rashis are true about this. A number of other Rishonim who strongly took the position that they feel the list is limited to what you find in the explicit sources in the Mishnah and the Gemara. So this prompts a lot of discussion, again, in the interest of keeping things concise, we'll get into all the details. But nowadays, there are a lot of categories that are subject to debate about where they fit in. So let's say if the husband's not supporting the wife. Let's say if the husband can't support the wife. Let's say if the husband sees prostitutes. It's a big discussion in the Rishonim already, discussion in the later poskim. Let's say if the husband declares that he's homosexual, or that was proven to be the case from before. Does that constitute a basis for kfiya? So there are a number of contemporary issues that are dealt with in this context that are measured against the earlier standards of kfiya, and the question comes up. It's a very, very extensive topic in the literature to try to assess exactly how this fits. Now, one other major part of the puzzle, and this is another famous Rambam. So this Rambam, I guess, is the second most important Rambam in this area. And that is the question of Mois Alai. Familiar with that topic? It's a very important detail for this discussion as well. That Mois Alai is a phrase that appears in the Gemara in Ksuvos, but its application there is a little bit different. So the Rambam's position is a big fish. That the Gemara talks about a woman who is not interested in staying with her husband or in being physically with her husband and having relations with her husband. And the Gemara talks about different explanations she could give. And so, for example, if she says, I'm just trying to cause him problems, so then that's called moredes, so rebellious woman. It's important to understand, by the way, that that phrase could be badly misunderstood, because say moredes, it makes it sound as if the husband is the boss and she's rebelling against him. But the Mishnah makes it clear you can have moreid in both directions. The husband can be moreid, the woman can be moredes. It's bad moreidah against the marriage, really. That's really what it's about, because you can have a moreid or a moredes. But say if she's just trying to cause some tsar, so then that's what the Gemara calls a moredes. But the Gemara says she's not a moredes if she declares Mois Alai, which literally translates to, I find him disgusting. So there are a lot of questions to be dealt with here, One question is, what are the consequences of her declaring mois alai? So the Rambam has a very important chiddush, and it's very, very hotly debated in the Rishonim already, that mois alai basically means she's entitled to an automatic divorce, that kfiya would be applied in that situation. So the Gemara doesn't use it exactly that way. There's a lot to discuss about how the Gemara uses it, but this is very significant if this is true. Because the most expansive understanding of this is that the Rambam is saying that mois alai is basically a get out of jail free card. Because essentially it means that we will employ kfiya under these cases. And the other assumption, which is also debatable, but the assumption in the Rambam's words, is that mois alai is a completely subjective factor that anyone can invoke at any time. And basically, she doesn't have to explain it at all, and it doesn't have any substance that we understand necessarily. So what that translates to, if one takes the broadest reading of the Rambam, is that kfiya is always available when the wife doesn't want to live with the husband. So that would have major implications for kfiya. Again, that would similarly pretty much make every contested divorce situation to a automatic kfiya situation. So why is that not the case? So one reason is because a lot of the Rishonim and the Shulchan Aruch seem to disagree with the Rambam. So most poskim are not ready to rely on that Rambam by itself. Often the Rambam's view is quoted as a tziruf with other things, meaning that it's part of a larger puzzle and it is acknowledged. It also makes a difference where the community is. So, for example, Temani couples who follow the Rambam for everything, so it's also discussed, for example, in some of the Bavaji Yosef's Chubas and elsewhere, that maybe the Rambam's view is dominant in those communities. But in any event, it's often invoked. The Rambam's position is certainly given a lot of weight and discussed in a lot of contemporary poskim. But the fact that a lot of the Rishonim, really most of the Rishonim, didn't seem to accept it is a crucial point. It's also important to figure out, does the Rambam really mean it the way it's sometimes interpreted, that basically whatever one invokes doesn't need any kind of substantiation or explanation, it's just completely subjective, and that's the whole story? Or does it mean something a little bit more? Is there a difference between mois alai and I just want out, et cetera, et cetera? It's interesting to note, and again, this is such a long topic that we can only kind of point out highlights, but this is a subject you could give a lot more analysis to. But you see from the way some of the Rishonim disagree with the Rambam that they are not necessarily agreeing with each other in terms of the definition of terms. See that some of them, the terms are not necessarily the same in the way they argue. So, for example, the Tosfos Riddik Suvis, there are basically two levels of disagreement with the Rambam. Should I take your question first, or is this...
Where is this Rambam?
The Rambam is in Perek Beis. I'll have to tell you exactly where it is afterwards. I'll find a few. I didn't put it on the Rambam Komos, so we not have it.
I think it's
like that. Yeah, it could be. That's not Perek Beis, the first one. Yeah, so if it's not there, I'll show it to you later. You said it's what?
$2
test.
$2 for sure. And your test, your $2 for your deal.
Hold on a second. No, that's part of Meredith, yeah. But that's... So if it's not there, it's what? What did you say? All right, we'll find it later. Yeah, it's not exactly there. But in any event, so part of the debate, if you look at the Tosfos Rid, for example, So the Tosas Rid assumes that the Rambam is right in theory, but we can't act on it in practice. Basically, that he thinks that Molos Alai is subjective but real, but still means something. That is a meaningful sentence, meaning that we recognize the subjective emotion, so she's entitled to her subjective desire that she doesn't want to be with him, and that is real. But at the same time, it's not a get in jail free, because there are things that don't rise to that level. Meaning that the way the Tosfos Rit seems to understand it is that Ma'is Alai means that I don't like something about him, whatever it is. It can be something vague and ephemeral and mysterious. But it can't be, for example, that she's just interested in somebody else. And that's the concern.
How is that? I don't get what that means. But.
It means that it's a negative feeling about the husband. It's not a affirmative interest in some other guy.
But that's not for the Rambam doesn't care about that.
Well, the question is, what does he mean by Ma'is Alai? So Ma'is Alai might be something completely subjective and completely invisible to anyone else, but it has to be something negative about this person. So that's enough to say, I can't live with him anymore. Now, there are various philosophies that are going to emerge here in terms of the commitment of marriage. So how do we define the commitment that the couple is making to each other? So is it supposed to transcend any kind of change of feelings? Is it supposed to mean that everyone else is off limits specifically? So the Tosfos Rid's understanding seems to be that in theory this would be enough, but you can't expect an outside body to act on it and to exert kfiya because they have no way of knowing that it's really there. While the Rush, for example, the Rush in his Tshuvas, the Rush you see from his language that he's just talking about something else. Because the Rush says that you can't believe that you could allow a kfiya for Ma'is Alai, you know, just because, he basically says, just because she fell in love with somebody else, we're going to be kofin. So the Rush, you see the Rush and Tosfos Rid are not defining Ma'is Alai in the same way. And that's going to have a big impact in terms of what falls into what category. Again, this is a major part of the contemporary puzzle, the contemporary discussions, that when the wife invokes Ma'is Alai, to what extent does that affect the decision of kfiya? To what extent is that all defined in one way, or is there going to be a substantive discussion by the Beis Din as to different levels of Ma'is Alai, etc., etc.? All of that would be a discussion you would find in contemporary literature. Okay, so far so good. Alright, now if you're ready for another point of some interesting lumdas. So Reb Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva which he is not ready to rely on the Maisa, but he thinks the Svara is correct. And that also could be part of the background here, because this also has major impact on how the math adds up. Reb Moshe writes that, again, more l'svara than he's willing to say this is psak, but Reb Moshe feels that he thinks that when you have a situation, which has been described many of the contemporary deadlock situations, that the husband is willing to divorce his wife, but he has certain conditions, says then he thinks there would be no problem with kfiya and doing whatever it takes to force him. Because his understanding is that essentially he's willing to divorce him. It's just that he wants to try to extort something. So then, that's not called unwilling. In other words, what's the theory there? That forcing somebody to divorce in a way that doesn't work, a get bal karcha, that refers to people who want to stay married. But somebody who's not interested in staying married, but he's using the situation to try to extract something else, maybe there's no issue of Ratzon and Kfiya and the like. So that would have huge implications. Again, Reb Moshe is not willing to say that all the way. But that's, again, a part of the puzzle. Now, what's interesting, I know.
What does that mean that Moshe wrote a tshuva, but he doesn't think it's the Maisa?
He already said that he's not confident enough that the support for the Svarah is there, so he wouldn't act on it. But he thinks logically it makes sense. You can read it inside, I'll
read
that one.
So why is he put in Dibur Moshe as opposed to...
It's a fair question. I think it is also, again, a lot of these issues we'll see, there's a complex math, a complex calculus that goes with putting together all the different svaras, all the different factors, so it's important to mention as part of the background, but that's just it contributes to the lumpness of how this works. So what's interesting also, and this a little bit answers your question of why it's important that he says this, I haven't seen anyone who points this out, but this is the polar opposite of the tshuva of the Marashdam. The Marashdam has a tshuva with the Marashdam. He lived about 200 years before. So the Marashdam has a tshuva which a number of poskim talk about how much you have to worry about. And I think it's interesting, I think Rav Moshe is essentially the polar opposite of this tshuva, and that you could say arguably more authoritative than the Marashdam. So it's interesting that you don't see so much pitting of this Igros Moshe against the Marashdam. But the Marashdam says the opposite, basically. That he thinks that a situation that's already a category of kfiyah, but the husband is willing to divorce, but he has conditions, so then you can't be kofa. Because he's willing to do it, just he has his conditions, so then kfiyah is no longer viable. So some later posts can discuss, is the Marashdam right? Is he wrong? Even if he is right, what rises to this level? It's hard to imagine. It could be any kind of condition. It must be certain types of conditions that are related specifically to the marriage. There's a pretty extensive literature about this Marashdam. But I haven't seen people point out that it seems that Rav Moshe essentially rejects the svara, because Rav Moshe is the opposite svara, right? There's a polar opposites. Marashdam is basically saying that in a situation where kfiyah would have otherwise been established, but you can't do it because of the conditions. And Rav Moshe is saying the polar opposite, that even without kfiyah being established, you can do it because of the conditions. So I think that's a significant part of the puzzle, and it's something which should also be a major part of the discussion. It's also interesting, just as far as the lumdas, that I think Rav Moshe's svara parallels something that Rav Zalman Nechemi Goldberg wrote to the Chumrah. Zalman Nechemi Goldberg, we'll have to explain this in more detail in a few moments. If you're familiar with Zalman Nechemi Goldberg, he's one of the great Gedolei HaDor at the moment, a great Posek in Eretz Yisrael. And he is the co-author of the prenup together with Rabbi Willie. Now, we haven't really explained the prenup yet, but just to borrow from that discussion. So there are some who argue that the prenup constitutes a self-imposed penalty. So we'll explain in a few minutes, hopefully, why that's not necessarily the case. But those who make this claim don't necessarily see that Zalman Nechemi, who is the author of the prenup, has written against the whole validity of self-imposed penalties. And he has an article in a journal called Divrei Mishpat, where he explains why this is. And he says that, let's say somebody signs a contract to put a penalty on himself, that 10 years from now, if he's refusing to give a get, that this contract should obligate him. So why don't we call that willing? Because he committed himself to it. So part of his whole approach there is that even though you could say that it's his own will that made this all get set into motion, the will is only on writing the get, it's not on the divorce. So essentially it parallels Rav Moshe. That Rav Moshe is basically saying that if there's rutzim for the divorce, then we're not worried about whether the get is compelled or not compelled. And here, Zalman Nechemi is saying the other half of that even if there is some self-commitment to the get, but if there's no rutzim for the divorce, that's still a problem. So in other words, they both separate the divorce and the get, and see the divorce as the area where we're concerned if there is rutzim or not. Follow that? So I think Rav Zalman Nechemi and Rav Moshe are basically saying two halves of the same idea. And Rav Moshe is saying the opposite of the Marashdam. And that's something that's interesting to enter into the discussion. Okay, so all of this is about when is kfiyah justified, when is it not justified. But the next question is, what constitutes kfiyah? So that is a major, major question. So the concern is that if we have a situation where we're not convinced that kfiyah is justified, so then we're afraid to do anything that counts as kfiyah because that will invalidate the get and have all of the consequences that come with no get at all, and that's not something anybody wants. So if kfiyah works, if kfiyah is justified, so that helps. If kfiyah is not justified, so what other avenues are there? No?
But is it possible that in actuality, the kfiyah isn't justified, no one actually knows? Like, Beit Din does compel the husband, but in, like, the end, like...
Yeah, it's an interesting question. How far do you go with this? Right? At what point do you say at the end of the day that Beis Din acting in good faith, that creates the reality and it is what it is? And so that's a crucial question. So it's clearly limits as to how much you can investigate. There's also such a thing when ultimately something is done beratzon, so there's a concept, or is done at least with some kind of participation. So there's a concept, with all due respect to Neo-Hasidism, called Dvarim Shebalei Venim Dvarim, which doesn't address that, but basically means that when there's some kind of contradiction between an action being carried out and one's desires, so we don't necessarily pay attention to the inner desires, we pay attention to what's happening. So that has some relevance here. To what extent, you know, once something is ultimately done, somebody claims, oh, I never really wanted to, whatever it is, how much of an impact does it have? It's a complex discussion of itself. So basically, to take this to the next stage, let's say, of the mechanisms that we endorse here at Yeshiva, such as protest rallies and the prenup. So how do they work? So an important step to understand that all this was an introduction to is that our working assumption here, speaking on behalf of some of the postmen of the Yeshiva who were involved in this, that's Rabbi Schechter and Rabbi Willig and the like, that these methods do not constitute kfiyah. So they're not working off the assumption that kfiyah has to be justified in order for these methods to work. Now, the possibility that kfiyah is justified is good because that provides an important safeguard. So, for example, if no, for your question you just asked a second ago, you know, what if it turns out that one of these methods crosses the border into kfiyah? So then, okay, if it happens to be there's what to rely on, that maybe kfiyah was justified anyway, then that helps. So l'chakila is certainly not relying on the assumption that kfiyah is justified. But these strong possibilities that kfiyah may be justified, whether it's because the couple is living apart and the Shechtesvara and those who may have agreed with that, or it's because something about Rimoshesvara, or it's because any one of the other conditions that contemporary posts can have suggested, so, or whether it's the Rambam's Mois Alai, which again would cover a whole lot of situations. So the fact that there are possible premises for kfiyah helps after the fact, but we're working off the premise that these methods don't constitute kfiyah. Hi.
Is taking someone out of the yid considered kfiyah?
So probably not. So that's again, that we'll just try to discuss this now. So the major concept that helps us to draw the line one way or another is something called Harchakos to Rebbeinu Tam. So as with many of the writings of Rebbeinu Tam, we usually have to rely on secondary sources for his opinion. They just came out a few months ago with a sefer on Chumash of Rebbeinu Tam. Apparently that was a manuscript they found, I think. So a lot of what we have from Rebbeinu Tam was clearly one of the Gedolei HaRishonim, but a lot of what we have from him, he's quoted in other Rishonim, he's quoted in Tosfos, and the like, so sometimes we have different versions. So this is crucial here because Rabbeinu Tam is a major player in this discussion. So Rabbeinu Tam has this idea that there is this concept of distancing oneself from someone, which does not constitute kfiya. And the assumption is, this is also a somewhat complex point, that this is less than cherem. Cherem apparently is too much, because the Rishonim explain that hitting somebody with physical force, that should constitute kfiya. That seems to be one of the basic examples of what kfiya is, using physical force to compel someone to do something. So the Gemara has a statement in a few places that cherem is worse than malchus. So when you rise to the level of cherem, it's a little bit of a problem that could actually constitute kfiya. But Rabbeinu Tam has this notion of harchakos, we call it nowadays harchakos to Rabbeinu Tam, which apparently don't rise to the level of cherem and don't constitute kfiya. Now, Rabbeinu Tam has a lot of street cred on this issue because, and it's an important point, because Rabbeinu Tam very strongly disagrees with the Rambam's Mois Alai idea. You know, the idea that Mois Alai could be enough to justify kfiya. So on the one hand, you don't have that endorsement from Rabbeinu Tam. So it helps that he is the one who endorses the Harachakos, because that emphasizes that it's not called kfiya. Basically, at the same time, he's saying, watch out, don't do kfiya in these cases, but you can do these things. So that becomes very significant. So what are the Harachakos to Rabbeinu Tam? It's also a big discussion in later posting. But basically it is a removal of services and a distancing. And that would include not letting somebody daven in your minyan, not letting someone enroll in your school, enroll children in your school, all kinds of other communal services and engagements are included potentially in Hachakas Rabbeinu Tam. So basically a lot of tactics that you see nowadays, let's say, Ora's strategies, which involve also protests and involve not associating with people. So the working assumption is that these are in the category of Harchokos to Rabbeinu Tam. Now, as you can imagine, there is some controversy as to what constitutes Harchokos to Rabbeinu Tam and what doesn't. That's also why this topic can continue to be an ongoing discussion. It's also a minority view of the Shach that we don't do Harchakas to Rabbeinu Tam nowadays. That's not the generally held assumption, but here you're talking about very contentious issues with people arguing on both sides, so don't be surprised to find those who will point the views that even Harchakas to Rabbeinu Tam shouldn't be done nowadays. But the mainstream approach is that Harchakas to Rabbeinu Tam are valid and appropriate, and the subject of analysis as to what is included and the like, but theoretically, that's a workable approach. Yes, sir?
What is the Shach's reason why it's not appropriate?
Because I think he thinks it rises to a level of cherem, and cherem is a problem, the way it plays out nowadays. Again, putting together the puzzle of what exactly is cherem Harchakos to Rabbeinu Tam requires a little bit of detective work. And some of the... this is an interesting point also. Some of the Rishonim will quote Rabbeinu Tam. So they write that the reason Harchakos Rabbeinu Tam don't rise to the level of kfiya is because a person can always move. If he's not happy the way he's being treated in this neighborhood, so let him get up and leave and go somewhere else. So the fact that nobody here wants to talk to him, nobody wants to daven with him, nobody wants to have any association with him, that's not compelling him to do anything. He can always get up and go somewhere else.
When did Posting write that?
In the medieval era.
Yeah,
Rishonim who quoted, some of the Rishonim who quoted that time. Now, isn't that
kind of surprising? Because wasn't a cherem in the medieval era like very strong? Like, even you couldn't necessarily just pick up.
Oh, this is not a cherem, that's the point.
Oh, I thought you were...
Oh, yeah, the crucial issue is that a function of Tom is considered to be less than a cherem. So not necessarily. People have moved, you know, all throughout history.
But I'm saying medieval.
It doesn't have to be easy. Especially if you don't want it to be
able.
Right. Theoretically, it's possible. No one's being forced to do anything. But if I'm going to beat you up with a stick, so then we could say I'm forcing you because you're going to keep beating me until I do it. But if I just say I'm going to have nothing to do with you and I'm making it unpleasant for you here in Washington Heights, so say, okay, so I'll go somewhere else. So it's an interesting question to analyze. First of all, one of the questions is in Eretz Yisrael, they have far more latitude in terms of what they can do. So they remove driver's licenses, and they remove passports and the like. So that's an interesting question some of the contemporary posts can discuss. What if they take away your passport and their hachachas Rabbeinu Tam are extending throughout the whole country of Israel? So does this still apply? Maybe there's taka nowhere they can go to escape it. Does that matter? That's a question some of the posts can talk about. But it's also interesting to wonder, how is this true in the internet age, in the global era? So my experience has been that your initial thought would be that, oh, nowadays you might say there's nowhere you could go, right? Because people could do social media campaigns that can reach the entire world. And therefore, nowadays maybe we have to worry that the Rabbeinu Tam's logic doesn't apply because there really could be nowhere to escape the impact of this. But the truth is, experience has been, it's been the opposite. Then the other unintended consequence of social media and the like is that people who are inclined a certain way are able to find each other, and you end up having these Ari Miklat that exist. I could name some places, but I won't publicly, that essentially develop where people who all feel that they're justified in acting this way create their own communities and their own chevra. And the reality is that I guess the same social media that allows the message to get to the whole world also allows like-minded people to form their own groups that kind of insulate them from this. And therefore, you know, for better or for worse because it means that it's less effective, but in terms of the concern of Rebbeinu Tam that it's not kfiya because you can escape, it's still true you can escape. Even in the era of Facebook and Twitter, it is possible to ignore all that and find somewhere to go. So, in any event, that's the rallies and things that we have like that and other social avoidance techniques. That is basically working off the premise of the premise of Achak Shabbat and Tam. Hi.
Speaking of things that were under harem, I just read about this last night, about
Nazifa. Nazifa. So Gemara has different terms that sound like they mean cherem. So Nazifa is probably identical to cherem for our purposes. A cherem seems to mean, that's where Shetros explains it, that it means basically a claw of the person should drop dead. It's considered to be somewhat extreme, right? The Gemara Moed Katan, which has Hilchos Avelos together with Hilchos Cherem, so the Gemara groups the two together and explains because the idea is the person who's mecherim is basically sitting shiva for himself because he's been told that he should drop dead. So that's considered to be somewhat extreme, and because the Gemara has the statement that it's more than malchus, so that's where you get this concern. Nazifa probably for these purposes means the same thing. So the language of cherim derbeva harchak, it's an important typo not to say, of harchakis derbeinu tam is that it's supposed to be less than that. Now again, if you have a basis to say that kfiya is applicable, so then theoretically cherem should also be allowed, because if malchus are allowed, then cherem should also be allowed. But again, we're try to avoid going there just because we're not sure what circumstances justify kfiya, what circumstances don't. So this is going to depend from one bezin to the next, but let's say if a bezin is sure that kfiya is clearly justified, they might be comfortable saying cherem and not worrying about where that language goes. But under the circumstances where there's room to wonder if kfiya is fully justified, so then harchakas derbeinu tam, the premise is that you don't need kfiya to be justified to employ cherem. That's like the third time I said that today. Harchakas derbeinu tam. It's like Rosh Hashanah, it's harchakas derbeinu tam. So almost. So harchakas derbeinu tam don't need kfiya standards. Now, it's also a discussion, does it need any standards? So, for example, was Rabbeinu Tam saying that, okay, mois alai, that doesn't justify kfir. Instead, do harchakas to Rabbeinu Tam. So does that mean there's some threshold, mois alai has to be defined a certain way, and then harchakas to Rabbeinu Tam are employed? Or does it mean, no, there's no real hard, fast halachic rules for what's necessary for halachas to be done? Whatever the poskim of that area decide, whatever that community decides to react in this way, it's not going to interfere with the kashrus of the get. That's the way Rabbi Willick has articulated it, that he thinks that when you're talking in the category of halachas Rebbe Natan, you don't have to worry that maybe, like you raised before, maybe klapei shmaya galia, that there's some kind of deficiency in it. That, listen, if you're humiliating a person, shaloki din, and that's clearly something you're going to want to do tshuva for, it's clearly a mistreatment to somebody, not a small matter, but in terms of invalidating the get, the understanding of many poskim along those lines is that this will never interfere with the get, and even if it would turn out that it was not justified, even if it would turn out that it's not warranted, however you would establish that, it's not called kfi at all, and the get is not affected by it. That's the method that get involved in the category of Halakas Rebbe Natan are addressing that category. So now, to get to the third level, so I think we only have a few minutes before Mincha, so I'll just try to lay it out a little bit. I guess in the next week we will add a little bit more, and I'll give you some of those missing covers to look at for next week. But, okay, so we've seen sometimes you have full-blown kfiyah. Sometimes, even if kfiyah is not justified, protests and social distancing in the category of harchakas Rebbe Natan, that might be effective. The third category you could consider are legal remedies that are hopefully not based on either, not necessarily because of harchakas Rebbe Natan, and are not working off the assumption of kfiyah. And here you have a couple of categories. You have get laws, which are at varying degrees of either efficiency or acceptability, and the prenup. So to give the very short 10-minute version, just to try to describe what's been involved in these fronts, and maybe we can flesh this out a little bit next week before going on to something else. But there are a couple of get laws that have been tried, have been promoted, and they are at varying levels of controversy. So in New York State, there have been two versions of the get law. The first one was much less controversial, but also not so effective. And the second one was highly controversial. And I believe just was challenged in court, and I'm actually up on the details about that. But the first get law involved that the court could refuse to issue a divorce, a civil divorce, if the one part or the other is preventing a religious divorce. So that doesn't really raise much halakhic concern. There isn't really much objection to that idea. I think pretty much, according to just about everybody, the problem was that it doesn't always work, because one part or the other can decide, okay, I'll live without a civil divorce. The same way they're living without a halachic divorce, they live without a civil divorce, and sometimes they need it, and therefore it'll make a difference, but there are many ways to get around this where it doesn't seem to impact people's lives as much as the intent was that it should, and people have been able to avoid this. The second get law was much more controversial, and that basically allows a judge to decide in the distribution of property that an impediment from one side or the other keeping them from remarrying could be factored into the distribution of property. So that, a number of poskim were very uncomfortable to different degrees, because they feel that that constitutes essentially compulsion. So we haven't yet really got into the question, which is a major element here, of how much financial compulsion constitutes compulsion. It's a major sugya in the Rishonim, but it sounds like it's at least something to be very concerned about, that financial pressure is considered to be compulsory. So there are those who argue, so what's basically happening here is that the judge can essentially steal the husband's property in order to force him to give the get, because the premise of phrasing that way is that if the get was given, so this property would have been assigned differently. In other words, that the law would have seen this property as going to the husband. But because they want to compel him to give a get, so the judge is going to take away his property and compel him to do so. So those who object to this, not everybody, but those who object to this understand it to be a form of financial control. Not everyone sees it as so problematic. There are a number of svaras not to. Dalibov Schwartz has expressed his opinion that he doesn't think it's so problematic. He's written about it. Schechter told me he doesn't think it's necessarily to the other problematic. Michael Broy wrote an article once where he wrote that he thinks it's a bad idea for a lot of reasons, but there are a number of reasons after the fact when it's employed to not see it as disqualifying. But there are many who were very opposed to this. Rabbi Bleich is extremely opposed to this, and others agree with him. It's a whole big debate as to the impact this law has on the kashrus of Gittin that are connected with it. Noah?
Is not giving someone a job also considered financial compulsion?
Probably not. Probably more in the kind of the category of hachakas to ben tam. It's a question of getting somebody fired. It might be a little more complicated. That's where you're going to have a little bit of a fight. But where does that fit in? Now, as we'll also see, again, we're going to have to wrap up in a minute. We'll have to talk about the prenup more a little bit next week. But there is a lot of debate as to what constitutes what. You know, what is considered to be compulsion, what isn't considered to be compulsion. Rav Moshe has a tshuva also endorsing the first get law. He doesn't see that as problematic. But there are a lot of back and forth about various svaras here as to whether it's going to enter into one category or the other. What's considered to be hachakas Rebbein Tam, what's considered to be affirmative, is considered to be simply the denial of services. That's a part of where this whole discussion comes in. So if one assumes that financial coercion is also a type of coercion, so that's where you get into the question of how do you view the prenup. That prenup, those who object to the prenup, and unfortunately there's been a number of objections in the past year, which I think are a little bit missing the actual theme of what's happening, but unfortunately it's been some prominent opposition. But the premise is that this constitutes, the prenup basically involves the husband committing to support the wife even after separation. That's basically the main bite of it. Although, I think I mentioned this last week, that I think that that's even not the most effective part of it. That the most effective part of the prenup is really the other part, that there is an agreement that the two parties will agree to have their issues dealt with in a predetermined venue. And in my experience, that would resolve 98% of the cases. Because the vast majority of issues that drag on forever are about venue shopping. So each side says, I'm right, and that my Beis Din or my court will show that I'm right, and as soon as you do the right thing and come to my venue, this will all be over. And it can literally drag on forever because each side won't agree that the venue the other one has chosen is going to yield those results. So if you could take that decision out of either one's hands and say that here's where it's going to be dealt with, that would really take care of the vast majority of cases. So, and that shouldn't be controversial at all. So for example, when Ora says that everyone should insist on a prenup, so they point out that even if you have objections to the financial prenup, still at the minimum, a prenup of an agreement to arbitrate in a specific venue, it's very hard to see why that should be controversial at all, and we should insist on at least that much. But beyond that, the premise of the prenup that we have, the RCA prenup and the like, that has been endorsed by a good number of the yeshiva, is that that doesn't constitute financial coercion. That essentially it's an extension, and it's based on earlier models that you find in earlier centuries. But that, if you want to listen, Rabbi Willick has a quite fascinating description somewhere in Wayi Torah about the whole story about how it was written and how it was created and his meetings with Rabbi Zalman Chaim Goldberg. It's quite a dramatic story, so very interesting. But there's a lot of details to it. But the basic premise is that marriage requires the husband to support the wife. And therefore, as long as they're still married, so he should still be supporting her at a rate that is established beforehand, that is meant to be, on the one hand, high enough that no one's going to want to let this go on too long, but not too high that it becomes absurd, because we have to be concerned about asmachta. We're concerned that somebody's committing himself to something that he never would be able to think could ever come up. So if it's a ridiculous number, so then that's vulnerable to an asmachta concern. But keeping it at the highest rate you can have, while still making it have some teeth to it, that's basically the goal. And that may be something that should be adjusted for different communities in different countries in different areas, but that might be the case. But in any event, the premise there is that this is something that shouldn't be considered coercive, because this is just the regular extension of the marriage agreement. So as you mentioned, Reb Zalman Chaim Goldberg, who was the co-author of the prenup, he himself was fiercely opposed to self-imposed penalties. So this is clearly not the way he conceptualizes that it's a penalty, but rather that it is simply the extension of the marriage, of the marriage agreements. And that's why it's particularly, I think, misguided some of those who have opposed it in recent months, and who said, oh, it's terrible, it's a self-imposed penalty. So the author of the prenup, he himself said that he doesn't think self-imposed penalties work, so it's clearly not the way they're conceived. You could argue this amount de facto to a penalty. That's what to talk about, but the premise clearly is that it is not. One of the most astounding objections I saw, which really is baffling, is somebody who signed an objection said that, oh, this is all coerced, because since the wife won't marry him unless he signs the prenup, or since the Masada Kedushin won't officiate unless he signs the prenup, so therefore he's forced to do it. That is completely baffling. That's basically like saying you shouldn't have to pay your mortgage, because since they wouldn't sell you the house unless you signed the mortgage, so you signed it under duress. So you shouldn't have to pay for your car, because since you only agreed to pay, because they wouldn't give you the car without it. I mean, it seems very, very difficult to understand how that is a valid objection of any kind. So what's also interesting is that there's another objection that you see kind of developing more and more nowadays, which also seems to be a logical contradiction as far as I can tell, that now they have, quote, tzaddikim, who say, I want to give the get, but I can't, because it'll be coerced if I do, because my posek told me that it will be coerced. So I don't really understand how that could work, because it seems to be a logical contradiction to say, I'm refusing to do this because I'm being forced to do this against my will. So it would seem that those are contradictory terms, that if you're able to refuse, then you are not being forced. So it would seem that one should undermine the other, but that is essentially part of the debate that you see nowadays. So we're being forced to stop against our will, so we could daven mincha. So to substantiate what we're saying, to just explain some of the details, God willing, we'll just give a few more minutes to this next week, and then eventually we have to start welcoming Purim.